This is us choosing a set of policies that is the worst of both worlds, that is both deregulatory and anti-competitive. And instead, you can do both.
This is episode 258 of the Community Broadband Bits podcast from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. I'm Lisa Gonzalez. This week, Christopher visits with two other policy folk from the Roosevelt Institute, Marshall Steinbaum and Rakeen Mahmood. Earlier this year, the Roosevelt Institute released a report that examines how antitrust enforcement has changed and how those changes have impacted the telecommunications industry. Christopher, Marshall, and Rakeen consider how that approach has affected people who may or may not subscribe to internet access services. You can download the report and learn more about the organization at rooseveltinstitute.org. Now here are Christopher with Marshall Steinbaum and Rakeen Mahmood.
Welcome to another edition of the Community Broadband Bits podcast. I'm Chris Mitchell, and today I'm speaking with two folks from the Roosevelt Institute, Marshall Steinbaum, the senior economist and fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And we also have Rakeen Mahmood, the program director at Roosevelt Institute. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
I first was aware of you guys several years ago because of some work that Susan Crawford was doing with you, I believe. And I saw what really great work you were doing. And then I read the Crossed Lines report, Why the AT&T Time Warner Merger Demands a New Approach to Antitrust. And I thought it was terrific. I'm excited to talk about these kinds of issues today. But I thought that we'd start maybe by asking and reminding people that it's been 21 years since the Telecommunications Act of 1996. It promised to basically get rid of monopoly and have incredible competition, and we'd all see more investment, lower prices, and generally higher quality services. What happened? And I think maybe Marshall would be the best person to start off.
Yeah, so I think that legislation was driven by two major assumptions about the telecommunications sector. And essentially, the problems that we've seen in this area are due to the fact that both of those assumptions turned out to be false. When the act went into effect, it did not have the effect that was forecast ex ante. So those two assumptions are that if you allow corporations to compete with one another across modes, they will do so, lowering prices, increasing variety, increasing innovation, and the benefits of doing that will flow to the consumers. And secondly, that new technologies would be forthcoming in the field of telecoms such that the old modes of communication would be made obsolete, and thus it was less imperative that they be regulated in the public interest in the way that they had been under the 1934 Act. So there was this idea that technological advance was inevitable. This advance would create new ways of communicating. And because we would have those new ways of communicating, we didn't need to keep such a vigilant eye on the old ways of communicating.
It's actually really interesting, because in some ways, you know, if one or the other had failed, you might have had a better environment. But the fact of the first one actually influenced the second one, which is to say that, you know, broadband over power lines and satellite, they certainly didn't live up to the hopes of 1996. But some of the wireless technologies probably could have, if they were not captured by some of those entities that should have been competing with them.
Yes, I completely agree with that. So it's not as though we didn't get new technologies since 1996. Everyone knows that we did. But we had these technologies come in, but they didn't actually compete. Instead, they just merged, and the existing dominant players just sort of extended their footprint into these new sectors. And there was no meaningful sense in which you could kind of get around the monopolized old telecommunications network through the use of some sort of magically competitive new one. I also think that the critical issue here is that we implemented this deregulatory regime in telecoms that said, well, we're not going to essentially require the equitability and access that we had under the 1934 regime. But we also, at the same time, had an antitrust and competition policy that was extremely favorable to consolidation. So the whole benefit of deregulation is supposed to be that competition serves the consumer, but what we actually got was not competition, but rather just consolidation and deregulated private monopolies, which is sort of the worst of both worlds.
Because you have economist in your title, I want to just make one additional point with relation to this that's a little bit more general, and I'm curious how you'd react, which is that this seems like policymakers are Charlie Brown and competition is the football that keeps getting pulled away. And I would just point to, I believe it was Adam Smith who noted that basically if you put a bunch of people who are in the same trade together in a room, the first thing they talk about is how to restrain trade. And yet with policymakers, it seems like there's this idea that, oh, they really want to be in competition with each other. And it seems like a mistake we make over and over again.
Yeah, I think that's by design. I mean, I don't think Charlie Brown kept getting deceived, whereas these deregulatory policies are implemented knowing that, you know, they're not going to end up serving the consumer, even though the ideology says that they will. What you just described, that, you know, Adam Smith says that when companies or suppliers get together, they do nothing but conspire against the public interest. That was the view, that was the ideology that the people who promoted the 1996 Act espoused with respect to the old regime, to the 1934 regime. That is what they kind of conjured up, this so-called public choice economics, where what happened under the 1934 regime was that cozy old AT&T or Ma Bell in the olden days would get together with their friends at the FCC and figure out how to screw over America. And so they had this whole ideology of deregulation that was supposed to do what Adam Smith is saying needs to be done in terms of breaking up anti-competitive cartels in a regulated industry. And so they kind of took that to the table and said, all right, well, let them compete with each other. We'll have not just competition between the baby bells and what among the baby bells with AT&T and vice versa in wireline telephones, but we'll also have that competitive model replicated over again when we get to these new technologies in broadband and in wireless. It turns out that there was a good reason for the 1934 legislation. In other words, when they tried this deregulatory approach, what actually happened was exactly what you described, and what Adam Smith said would happen, which is to say that the incumbent providers, free from oversight from the FCC, started getting together and figuring out how they could profit at the public expense.
And I think, Rakeen, maybe you want to come in to tell us a little bit about how this is really impacting people.
Yeah, I mean, I just wanted to point out that it's important to remember that the massive rise in consolidation after the 96 Telecoms Act had really major implications for digital equity as well. Because the broadband infrastructure is so often built on top of existing infrastructure and there are high fixed costs to building that infrastructure from scratch, low-income communities are often left out, both because they've been left out of previous infrastructure investments, what we call digital redlining, and because market concentration essentially incentivizes ISPs to provide service only to areas where they can make a profit. So low-income communities, and I should say here that income is highly correlated with race, which is important, are much less likely to be able to pay these high prices. Plus, extremely concentrated markets like telecoms provide a high barrier to entry for new market entrants. So the competition could drive down prices, increase innovation, and provide incentives for broadband provision to low-income areas. It's really hard to achieve that in this kind of market environment. And this type of market consolidation makes the conditions ripe for discrimination by large telecoms providers, which is actually exactly what happened in the 1990s.
So, Rakeen, I think, you know, it's an interesting question. If we had the kind of market competition that was envisioned and might be possible, do you think that would lead to better options for low-income folks or just more rigorous competition for middle-income and higher-income families?
I do think that it would improve things from an equity lens. Increased competition would essentially do a lot of the things that consolidation stifles, right? These mega firms don't have any incentive to innovate, for example, because they have such a stranglehold on their respective markets. Innovation is really important from an equity standpoint because it means finding cheaper and more efficient ways to deliver good services, which in turn opens up markets because lower costs mean that more people will be able to afford the service. And in turn, previously unprofitable markets would become more profitable for service providers. At the end of the day, monopolized private providers are only going to care about serving the highest margin consumers, and that's historically been the case. So if we had all infrastructure, internet infrastructure in private hands, it would cost a lot of money and not be even be available to disadvantaged communities. And the whole idea behind deregulation suggests that every community can get the level of service it wants, assuming that companies will offer fast and expensive services to those willing to pay a lot and slower and cheaper services for those willing to pay less. But more often than not, it's slow and expensive services provided to the rich and nothing for everyone else. So a more competitive system really would expand the types of people who have access to services, but also improve the quality.
So I just imagine the cable lobbyist response to this, and I'll direct this to you, Marshall, would be, look, we've invested trillions of dollars, billions of dollars, whatever they want to say. Speeds have never been higher than they are now. You know, AT&T will say there's more than 100 communities in which if you live at the right address, you could get fiber. There are people who have choices. What exactly have we not received because of the consolidation?
I think Europe offers the most obvious kind of alternative history for what we could have had in the United States, not to say that their telecoms regulatory or competition policy regime is perfect, but they have many more options available to consumers at all income levels. Essentially, all of those options are better than all of the options that are available here. And the sort of mythology that Rakeen just referred to, that deregulation is good because everyone gets what they want, just simply hasn't been borne out here. And Europe has, first of all, a much more stringent set of guidelines that prevent the full consolidation in each of the modes that we've had in this country. That's from a sort of antitrust and competition policy perspective. And secondly, they just have much stronger regulatory mandates on companies to provide free and equal service at a high quality to customer bases in some degree, regardless of ability to pay. So what they have done is kind of retained the flavor of the 1934 regime that was started to be undone by the antitrust case against Ma Bell here in the early 80s. They are operating at full tilt a telecommunications network where, in effect, the rich are subsidizing the poor through a pooling equilibrium, to use the economics jargon. And we decided not to do that anymore in this country. And I think Europe shows that it can be done with the same, if not better, innovation, the same, if not better, service. It's not like they're laboring in the medieval past at the way that those same lobbyists you referred to would say, we've invested, and had we not gotten the profits associated with that investment, then the U.S. telecommunications infrastructure would be much, much less dense than it is, and with lower service. We know for a fact it isn't true.
Right. Many areas would love to have the investment that a few cities have at this point. So we obviously see a great disparity across communities. One of the things we've seen, and there's good arguments that one may want to have net neutrality legislation and requirements, even if you had robust competition. But when you don't have robust competition, it seems all the more important. But I think some of the issues around net neutrality, which I suspect almost everyone who's listening understands, it's just the idea that your ISP shouldn't be able to overly influence you or tell you how to use the internet, more or less. I'm curious. I think there's some deeper issues that don't always get discussed unless you're reading all of the personal writings on Harold Feld's blog or something like that. So, Marshall, I'm wondering if you can give us a sense of something we should be looking at with regard to some of the things that are happening around net neutrality right now.
Right. So I imagine that your listeners won't be surprised to hear that Ajit Pai has been up to some nefarious dealings in his current position.
Yes. FCC Chairman Pai is, has long been kind of a foe of our way of thinking, and we're quite concerned with him.
And I think what's striking about what's happened since he became the chairman is the sort of surgical precision by which he has operated the different levers of the federal bureaucracy in such a way that it benefits his old friends and colleagues at Verizon and their peers. So in particular, you know, he's, as we know, he is dismantling the set of policies referred to as net neutrality. And one of the ways that that is going to be done is by removing the market participants' recourse to complain about unequal treatment and discrimination from the FCC and its various mechanisms for adjudicating common carriage to the FTC. So the Federal Trade Commission has a consumer protection and antitrust and competition mandate. That's what it does. It is not sector specific like the FCC. But what is quite true about the FTC is that it only really cares about what it calls consumer welfare or consumer surplus. Its job, if it has any job, is to serve consumers. I mean, hopefully they're at least doing that. But net neutrality and the issues that arise therefrom are just inherently not solely a consumer-facing issue. If an upstream content provider feels it's being discriminated against by an internet service provider, by a distributor of in any one of the telecoms modes, in order to win a case or win some sort of proceeding before the Federal Trade Commission, they have to somehow show that consumers are actually being harmed. And that is just hard to do. It would be like saying, you know, I'm Netflix, say, and I'm being kind of held up and forced to pay through the nose by an internet service provider. You know, I have to say that the real person, the real entity being harmed here is consumers. And that's possible. It's certainly the case that consumers can be harmed by upstream discrimination. But the point is that upstream content providers have they have rights under the communications regulations that go beyond whether discrimination and unfair treatment harm consumers. Under the old way of doing things, under the Section 2 of the 1934 Act and as extended by the prior administration at the FCC, the content providers can go to the FCC and say, you know, I've been discriminated against, that's not fair, and stop there. And they don't have to prove any claims about the impact on consumers. So this sort of bureaucratic wrangling where you take this whole function and move it from the agency where the plaintiffs, so to speak, get a hearing to the agency that is structurally reluctant to grant a hearing to upstream content providers of various kinds, you're just automatically weakening the common carriage principles that underlie net neutrality.
I think one of the things to be concerned about is not necessarily where Chairman Pai is going right now, but if we see this administration continuing to basically be so unpopular, and we see this issue of net neutrality at the FCC also showing so much resistance of the public and businesses to changing the regime, I think one of the things we fear is that Congress may come in. And there, again, we may see Republicans in Congress striking a deal in which they're trying to push this to the FTC as well. Is that something that you'd be afraid of?
Yes. There's a couple of different FTC process reform bills. I'm not aware of like draft legislation that does that, but it may exist. I certainly don't have a complete knowledge of what's going on in Congress in this area. But I think your general concern that either if the administration doesn't think it can get what it wants through the purely administrative procedures, or I think, you know, it's pretty clear that that Chairman Pai is, you know, serving the interests of an outside master, so to speak. If they don't feel like they can get what they need just solely through administrative functions, then they will bring the matter to legislation. And, you know, given what happened in 1996, I would fear what that might bring about in terms of Congress, because these companies have they have lots of influence on both sides of the aisle and in Congress. On the other hand, I think it is fair to say that the sort of very strong ideology that powered the 1996 Act has tempered to some degree in Congress. And so you're not going to get the sort of one-sided hearing that went down in 1996. On the other hand, of course, that was a kind of strongly bipartisan legislation. Whereas, you know, given that one party controls all of Congress right now, you could see a much more partisan thing playing out where the ultimate policy outcome is just as bad as, if not substantially worse than what happened in 96.
Rakeen, one of the things that, we come back to at the Institute for Local Self-Reliance is kind of watching the horror show at the federal level and then trying to figure out what we can do about it at the local level. And I think you've been looking at a project that we recently discussed with Joshua Breitbart in New York City about Queensbridge and a large low-income housing development. What's going on there?
So as many of your listeners probably already know, there are lots of municipalities getting around the federal policy landscape by experimenting with different models of municipal broadband. So one model that I just want to throw out there is the model in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where the city has established a municipal utility that provides a high-speed, low-cost broadband for all the city's residents, and it subsidizes it for lower-income people. And then another is the Queensbridge project, which you just mentioned. This is a demonstration project in New York City, and my team at Roosevelt is currently writing a case study on it with Maya Wiley, who is the former counsel to the mayor and actually currently a faculty member at the New School.
And just a wonderful person.
She's great. She's super sharp. So the Queensbridge project, just to give a quick overview, provides a free and extremely fast internet to the residents of the Queensbridge Houses, which is actually the largest public housing development in all of North America. And in the case of the Queensbridge project, the city contracts with an outside ISP, but owns and maintains all of the physical infrastructure. So I think there are two interesting things here. First, Queensbridge provides a vision for what municipal broadband could look like in the future. This is a service that's treated like a utility, provided by the government, and it's free. Second, I brought up Chattanooga because I think both Chattanooga and Queensbridge provide different models of municipalities experimenting with elements of a public option. And I think both models have their merits. In many ways, the Queensbridge model prioritizes equity because the folks working in City Hall at the time, such as Maya and Josh, realize that even a cheap plan, say $9.99 a month, is 10 bucks that could be better spent on food, clothes, or other necessities. The Queensbridge plan really does prioritize providing internet to the people who are most marginalized from the broader telecom industry. Chattanooga, in a lot of ways, is more of a traditional public option. It doesn't provide free services to anyone, even though there are subsidies for lower-income consumers.
You know, I think it's worth noting, and I don't know that the utility would provide a free option if they were able to, but Tennessee law does appear to prohibit them from offering a service at below the cost of providing it. So that's actually one of the reasons why, even though Chattanooga has done everything it can to provide a low-income service, paradoxically, the state is actually prohibiting them from doing a better job of serving low-income folks.
Right. And this is kind of a worrisome trend because we see states across the country imposing these state preemption laws, which restricts what municipalities can provide in terms of services. It seems to be on the rise that states more and more are keeping municipalities from offering these services in a really robust way to their citizens.
I think we're certainly worried about it more. I mean, we're more worried about it now than we have been in the future. But it is worth noting that local groups have been able to stop most of the efforts to establish these. So though we're having more fights now, we've mostly seen local groups stopping these efforts. So that's been terrific.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm excited to see that there's this increase in municipal experimentation. And I really am looking forward to seeing where this goes, both with Queensbridge and New York City, but also all of these other municipalities around the country.
One of the things that I think separates Queensbridge from Chattanooga, aside from a bunch of obvious things, is that Chattanooga built the network using an economic model that presupposed the network would pay for itself out of revenues for the network. Now, the Queensbridge model is fundamentally different. And I'm just curious if you have a sense of, as you think about this, you know, one of the things that worries me is that the Queensbridge, in theory, could disappear with a different mayor, I suppose. You know, what can we do to make sure that we're making investments that are going to be there for the long haul?
Yeah, this is something that has been really interesting in digging into this project. This question of how do you institutionalize these priorities is a big one that's come up over and over again. Certainly in the case of Queensbridge, Maya Wiley ended up securing a 10-year capital budget line. So there is kind of a 10-year secured funding source for Queensbridge and all of the projects that come out of the Queensbridge demonstration project. That being said, I share your concerns. You have to look out for political waves and whether or not, you know, projects like this will be able to withstand them.
My admiration for Maya grows because the 10-year funding is certainly it's very smart. Marshall, let me throw it back to you for any concluding comments on these issues.
I think, you know, we know how to do telecoms policy right because we used to do it right. The problem that has arisen, depending on how far back you want to go, whether to 96 or to 82 or potentially even to the 70s, is that we had an ideological revolution that said everything that we thought we knew about how to conduct a sound telecommunications policy was wrong. And, you know, we needed to have a huge shakeup that jettisoned all the principles that we had from the 1934 Act. And I think now after 30 or 40 years, we just know that that was one big failure, tour of disastrous policymaking. There's no reason to think that the same principles that led us to 1934 would fail again. I mean, we sort of have lost the capacity for certainly for ambitious antitrust and competition policy, and also for public serving regulation in the public interest. And part of that will always include a public option that provides for a competitive alternative and a low cost alternative that reaches all households and connects them to economic networks that are necessary for being an economic person in the modern era. So all of those principles were true in 1934, and they're still true now, and we don't need to continue to allow the fact that we had bad policymaking for 30 years set the parameters on for the future. We can do a lot better.
So just a quick clarification. I think some people might have just simplified their thinking about this and think, well, the previous policy was one of basically allowing a monopoly, whereas you are promoting an antitrust. So just square that circle for me, please.
Right. So I say both. So to characterize the kind of debate here, this is a simplification, but I think it's basically right. We had one big regulated monopoly doing telephone communications, it was different in broadcast, but more or less the idea was you had these large monopolies that served the entire country, and they had a mandate to provide equal quality services to everyone, where they were allowed to charge more to the people that had a high ability to pay in order to subsidize services to people with a lower ability to pay. When Ma Bell was broken up in the early 80s, the ideology of that was, let's bust up this highly inefficient monopoly using antitrust. So whereas altogether the policy revolution that took place in the 1980s wanted antitrust to be very inactive, to not get in the way of corporations that wanted to merge, they did use it to go after Ma Bell and supposedly introduce competition into this previously highly regulated sector. And what that did was kill off, again, the what an economist would call a pooling equilibrium by a strategy of cream skimming. So you had upstarts come in, poach the most profitable customers away from the smaller AT&T that came out of the 1982 restructuring, or 84 was when it was finally implemented. It made it impossible for the new AT&T to really function and serve in its regulated capacity. They were losing all of their most profitable customers to these upstarts that were that led us to the 1996 Act, where, as I said, the whole idea was lift these regulatory mandates off of AT&T and other incumbent providers, let them all compete with each other. We had these regulatory mandates. We also had walls around the baby bells that protected their geographic coverage from competition. And the idea was, you know, we have these issues in the sector stemming from the breakup of Ma Bell. Let's kind of solve those issues by injecting yet more competition. Regulation came off, and we got all of the catalog of troubles that we previously discussed. So the question is sort of, where do we go from here? I have said that the reason why the 1996 Act failed was because of lax antitrust policy. We thought these companies were going to compete with each other once they were deregulated, and instead they just merged with each other. And so the whole promise of competition didn't work because of that lax antitrust policy. Europe is the model here. And the reasons that the incumbent providers have put forward for why they can't do that here just are laughable to my mind. I mean, this is us choosing a set of policies that is the worst of both worlds, that is both deregulatory and anti-competitive. Should either an administration or Congress want to serve the public interest in this area, it is eminently technologically and feasible, and it could be constructed as a policy. We just have chosen not to do it.
I think that's a really good summary. Well, thank you both, and I'm excited to see what comes next from the Roosevelt Institute as you continue trying to make sure that we're not being abused by both a lack of competition and a lack of regulation.
That was Christopher with Marshall Steinbaum and Rakeem Mahboud from the Roosevelt Institute discussing antitrust enforcement and how it has affected telecommunications policy. We have transcripts for this and other Community Broadband Bits podcasts available at muninetworks.org/broadbandbits. Email us at podcast@muninetworks.org with your ideas for the show. Follow Chris on Twitter. His handle is @CommunityNets. Follow muninetworks.org stories on Twitter. The handle is @MuniNetworks. Subscribe to this podcast and all of the podcasts in the ILSR family on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Never miss out on our original research by also subscribing to our monthly newsletter at ilsr.org. Thank you to Arnie Huseby for the song Warm Duck Shuffle, licensed through Creative Commons. And thanks for listening to episode 258 of the Community Broadband Bits podcast.